I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Global warming, climate change, call it whatever you want, for the Inuvialuit hunters of Saxe Harbor in the high Arctic, it simply means that their life has already changed. They no longer venture out on the sea ice when they used to. It's not safe. And if it's not safe for them, it's also proving deadly for the caribou and the bears who once relied on it as a cold weather highway. The latest study of global warming involving hundreds of scientists over a four-year period confirmed that the Arctic is warmer now than it has ever been, and that the threat of rising seas and climate change are real. I'd like to take a look at the way NASA animates what's changing with the temperatures in the Arctic. You can go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. We're linked there to a NASA animation showing those temperature fluctuations, as well as other demonstrations of how climate change can be understood from way up in the sky. There is only one broad international agreement to control the release of dangerous greenhouse gases. It's called the Kyoto Accord, reached some 7 years ago. Now, it's only just now being road tested, as most European nations, others in Asia, and now Russia have agreed to use the Kyoto formula as a way to reduce greenhouse gases. The U.S., as we all know, originally agreed to the accord, but has withdrawn. This hour, we're going to do two things. We're going to hear the latest on the science, but we also then want to move to talk about what the implications are for the U.S. refusal to participate in the Kyoto Accord, especially now that we know it's going ahead. Will the international agreement make a difference on this planet without Washington's signature or participation? Maybe it's time to move past the Kyoto Accord, as some suggest, and find a more efficient way to ease global warming. We'd like to hear from you. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I said we're going to start with the science, and we're going to start with a man by the name of Dr. Lonnie Thompson. He is a glaciologist at Ohio State University's Byrd Polar Research Center. His admirers call him Iceman. He's joining us on the line now from Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Thompson, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
I understand that you spend much of your time up on the glaciers, pulling those ice samples out and studying those. Before we talk about the core samples, though, just the place where you stand, the glaciers, are they melting as fast as they are reported based on what you can see?
Yes. We've been working now 28 years in this field, and we've had the opportunity to revisit a lot of these sites. And not only are they retreating around the world, but there's an acceleration in that retreat over the last decade.
Can you give us an example, one glacier, one place that illustrates that?
Yes. If we looked at the largest tropical ice cap on Earth, Quelccaya Ice Cap down in the Andes of Peru, this ice cap is at 18,700 feet, and we've been monitoring the retreat of the largest outlet glacier there, Corycalis, since 1963. And we have about 10 maps of this glacier. And if you look at the first period of retreat from 63 to 78, the terminus is retreating about 4.7 meters per year. In the most recent period, from 2000 to 2002, that's up to 205 meters per year, 40 times faster, or about 1.3 feet per day. So you can almost stand there and watch it retreat.
I want to ask you about what the critics say when we talk about the science in this way. I'm thinking of a rebuttal I read not long ago about the ice cap on Kilimanjaro, 12 square kilometers a century ago, now down to just over 2 square kilometers. One of the scientists who argues against global warming says, you know, the weather's going to shift again. It's going to get cold again. The snows will come back to Kilimanjaro. What do you say when that's presented to you?
Well, I think the fact is the climate on this Earth has changed and changed dramatically in the past due to natural variability. The thing that is concerning to us today is that when you look both at glaciers like Kilimanjaro, but all the mountain glaciers around the world show this retreat taking place in today's climate, with the exception of a few glaciers in Norway and Sweden. And I think it's the scale. If you look at any one site, like Kilimanjaro, you could argue about how much of that is regional and the like. But when you put it in the context of a global view and you see what's happening, that's where the evidence is so compelling that the planet is warming up. And certainly ice, glaciers are probably our most visible form, way of viewing global warming.
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to take you next. These measures of glacial ice that you collect, the core samples you take from deep inside the glaciers, how far back in time do those samples actually take you?
Well, we have records that span now in the polar regions going back over 800,000 years. In the lower latitudes, we have a lot of records that go back to the last ice age. And so you can start to get a perspective of the change that's taking place in the 20th century by looking at that long-term history. And ice is a beautiful collector of the past, in that if you go high enough, every year is preserved. So you can go back year by year and look at how the system has changed in past due to natural variability. But you can also look at how it's changing in the 20th century where there's a human impact.
So a question about the weather 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years, there are some answers to that actually frozen into this ice.
Absolutely. And we have a perspective now going back 2,000 years in the tropics from glaciers both from the Andes in South America and from glaciers out of the Tibetan Plateau region. And in both of those areas, what they show is that the last 50 years have been the warmest in the compared to the last 2,000 years. And as these glaciers retreat, they're also revealing things that they have captured in the past that can even give us a longer perspective. For example, that Quelccaya ice cap, this largest tropical ice cap on Earth, at the margin where it's retreating, there have been recently plants being exposed. We've been able to collect those plants and date them, and they date back to 5,000 years before present. And because they're perfectly preserved and they're soft-bodied plants, there's no woody tissue, that these plants have not been exposed for over 5,000 years, which would say that what we have observed since 1963 in the retreat is certainly significant in the time frame of 5,000 years.
Just a final point, Dr. Thompson. I'm wondering, in your studying of what you see, if you ever allow yourself the time to think, to imagine what the impact of all this climate change will be for people going through their regular everyday lives. I know that there's going to be somebody right now sitting in their car going, yeah, climate change. We heard about it 10 years ago and 15 years ago, and my life goes on. What do you say to someone who kind of wants to shove it to one side?
Well, I think we have to be very concerned about this variability in the system. I mean, one of the things these high-resolution records show us is that the climate system, the natural system, is capable of very rapid changes over very short periods of time. It's occurred in the past due to things that had nothing to do with human beings. But today we have humans changing the Earth's composition through the greenhouse gases, the albedo of the planet. But the records from the past tell us we need to be concerned about the fact that the system is capable of changing very abruptly over very short periods of time. And that forcing could be either natural or human-driven. So I think this is something that we all need to be quite concerned about.
Dr. Thompson, I thank you for taking time today to talk to us about it.
Oh, you bet. Thanks.
Dr. Lonnie Thompson is a glaciologist at Ohio State University's Bird Polar Research Center. Chance now to introduce the two guests who are going to be with us for the balance of the hour. Timothy Wirth is joining us from Washington. He is president of the United Nations Foundation from 93 to 97, was Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, which, Tim, I think is a fancy way of saying that you were basically in charge of the U.S. participation in the years leading up to the Kyoto Accord, right?
That is correct, Dick. I was one of the primary negotiators of the Kyoto Protocol.
All right. Thanks for being with us. Roger Sedgo is there in the same studio in Washington. Roger's a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. That's a D.C. think tank analyzing environmental, energy, and natural resource issues. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
I wonder if I can start you off both with basically the same question, and that is that as we mull over what Lonnie Thompson has just told us, is the Kyoto Protocol, the Kyoto Accord, is it still the best way for the world to proceed? Is it the best way forward? Tim, do you want to start on that?
Well, I think Lonnie had it right. It's the first step. That's what the Europeans are saying. It doesn't by any means accomplish everything that has to be done. As Lonnie Thompson suggested, you know, the basic issue that we face are concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere, acting as a kind of greenhouse, and that's why the expression the greenhouse effect or the greenhouse problem comes in. The Earth is getting warmer because there's more carbon in the atmosphere. As we put carbon into the atmosphere, it stays there for 100 years. I mean, every gallon of gasoline that you burn in your car, about 2 pounds of carbon are produced, and that carbon goes up into the atmosphere and stays up there. Now, as this happens, the Earth underneath is getting warmer. And so the basic issue is, how do we reduce that carbon? The first thing we have to do is to stabilize the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And we're a long way from doing that. We have right now somewhere around 380 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. The historic norm was about 280 parts that Lonnie and others have found out by their work in ice and in seabed sediments. So we have to stabilize long-term the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. Kyoto, the Kyoto Protocol, it gets about 5% of the carbon. To stabilize carbon over the next 50 or 60 years, we're going to have to reduce carbon by 60 or 70%. So Kyoto is only a beginning, but like any long, difficult journey, you got to start somewhere.
Roger Sedgo, is Kyoto the best place to start?
Well, it's a place. There are a number of issues here. One finding of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is that there is global warming, and that the evidence strongly supports the notion that human activities are an important factor contributing to that warming, but not the only factor. So we've got a natural background upon which we have a series of human activities that are exacerbating what appears to be a natural trend. Now, given that situation, and I accept the basic notion that the scientific evidence supports human activities exacerbating this problem, and that something needs to be done to address that problem. But I think what's emerging from our first step, which the Kyoto Protocol certainly was, is that as it's configured now, the Kyoto Protocol is a poor vehicle for addressing many elements of that warming problem. And one of the activities that's going on these days among people thinking about the Kyoto Protocol is called Beyond Kyoto. When the protocol is finished, when the period 2008-2012 has passed, and the global community is anticipating and thinking about where does it go from here, the question is, will we just replicate a Kyoto approach, or will we come on with something fundamentally more useful in addressing this problem in the long term?
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. On this program, we're setting aside any scientific argument about whether or not global warming is caused by people or whether or not there are greenhouse gases. I know that argument still exists in some quarters. This hour, we're talking about the Kyoto Accord, and is it the best way to go ahead for the whole world in trying to control the release of greenhouse gases? The U.S. is out. Does that mean that the Kyoto Accord is perhaps not necessarily the best way to go ahead? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. One of my guests, Roger Sedgo, says that the Kyoto Accord is, in fact, a poor vehicle for moving ahead as an international way of controlling greenhouse gases. Timothy Wirth says it is a first step. We'd like to know what you think, because there's so much debate about the Kyoto Accord when we're talking about climate change. Should we be looking at directly at this, or should we be looking at something else? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. And Tim Wirth, I'm going to come back and just sort of ask you, again, keep it simple for us, because it gets a little bit complicated. But the case is made by Roger, and I've read it made by others, and you use the figures yourself. If Kyoto is only going to control 5% of what the scientists say ought to be a 50% control of carbon, of greenhouse gases, why not junk it, given the fact that Washington's not very interested in it, and say, right, technology's changed, a lot's changed in the past 7 years. Let's start again. Let's come up with something that everybody can buy into that works.
Well, we will be starting again. There's a little more of a framework in this. The Kyoto Protocol is the first attempt to implement the 1992 International Treaty on Climate. The U.S. ratified that treaty in 1992, as did some 185 other nations. The Kyoto Protocol is an attempt to implement that treaty, and it was a first step to try to figure out how you would get nations together, how you begin this process. Included in this, of course, are some of the issues like trading of emissions around the world, the issue that Roger knows a great deal about, which is, where are there carbon sinks around the world? What kind of credit do nations get for not cutting trees and so on? There were some very complicated technical parts of the Kyoto Protocol. As Roger correctly points out, we're going to get to a second budget period, and that's going to be coming up starting in 2012. That will be the next phase of Kyoto. In that, no question that we have to do at least two things. One, we have to engage India and China much more aggressively than they currently are. In the Kyoto Protocol and under the agreements reached in 1992, the industrialized nations had to go first. It's now time for India and China in particular to get involved.
Can I just stop you there, though, Tim? I mean, how do you draw India and China into this process if the United States, the biggest player, has stepped out?
Well, that's a major. You got to start the negotiations with them again. If the U.S. isn't going to step up to this, certainly India and China are not going to do it. That leads us to a second thing that has to be done in the second budget period, which is technology and technology transfer. Technological opportunities in terms of looking at new energy sources, looking at new technological capabilities, and sharing those with the rest of the world so that they, for example, burn coal much less efficiently, has to be part of sort of the second budget period that Roger correctly referred to. So again, Kyoto is a first start. We learned a lot from Kyoto. We got the process going. Now we have to negotiate a second part. And, you know, I believe fervently that the U.S. has to be engaged in this. As we speak, interestingly, your news program at the start pointed out that Tony Blair is in Washington today.
Right.
He has been a major advocate of a strong climate program around the world, probably the most significant political leader in the world on this issue, and he's going to be talking with the president about it today.
And Roger, if I take the point that Tim's making about staying with that track, what's lost? What's to be lost by at least having people work on that while the technological side unfolds? Are you saying it's just a waste of time, a waste of money to stay with Kyoto?
No, I think I'd agree mostly with most of what Tim said. You've got to recognize, as Tim pointed out, that we do have a UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. The U.S. is part of that convention. The Kyoto Protocol is, as was pointed out, a first step in this. The good news, I guess, is that we took a first step. The bad news is it probably was a bit of a stumble and wasn't the most efficacious way we could have initiated this process. I think what we're going to do is we're going to play out this hand and move after 2012 to a second step, and then the question will be, what's the nature of that step? How much have we learned from what we've accomplished during the first Kyoto Protocol, and where do we go from here? I should point out one more thing. I mentioned that the U.S. is part of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. I should point out two important things here. George Bush wasn't alone in rejecting Kyoto. In 1997, the Congress voted, the Senate voted 95-0 that it was not going to move ahead with any ratification of any treaties unless the developing nations were heavily involved. Well, Kyoto does not heavily involve the developing nations. So whether George Bush separated himself from Kyoto or whether the Senate would have been given the opportunity to do it, in either event, there was not broad support across the U.S. For going ahead with this.
All right, let's open this up to some of our callers. I want to go to Arlington, Massachusetts. Richard's joining us from there. Hi, Richard, what do you think?
I think that the really competitive corporations, the leading corporations such as British Petroleum, which now calls themselves Beyond Petroleum, are already moving ahead. This whole discussion is just, you know, I think, you know, countries like Japan with the Prius, they're already moving ahead, and they're going to be getting the jobs, they're going to be creating the jobs. And with Russia getting on board, my question is this, is what does that mean in terms of leverage? Are these guys going to be able to set trade standards in terms of to say to the U.S., now you've got to start exporting to us. We will set standards. You cannot export inefficient SUV, gobbling cars.
Jim, worth it. The economic implications, I guess, of the U.S. decision to stay on the sidelines.
Well, I think that they are very significant. I think that the energy future, energy is climate, climate's energy. That's the formula that you just have to think about climate change, you think about energy. This is, I think, the most significant jobs creator in the 21st century. We're going to have a revolution in energy technologies, and is the United States going to be the lead in that, or are we going to be hanging back? I think the jury's out on that. We don't know what's going to happen in the implementation of Kyoto, as a number of countries, almost every other industrialized country now, is going to try to implement the first phase of Kyoto. What does that mean? What kind of impacts is that going to have on their companies?
I do remember the president announcing some billions of dollars for hydrogen-fueled cars. Are you saying that's inadequate?
Well, it's so far down the line. I mean, that's 50 or 60 years down the line. Probably the immediate piece relates to hybrid automobiles or the brand new diesel technologies, the kind of items that your caller referred to. The steps to be taken relate to much more efficient power plants. The steps that be taken refer to much different, cleaner streams of fuels. Again, the kind of thing that BP and Shell have been doing.
Right.
There are some very significant industrial, economic, jobs-based opportunities, and I fear that the U.S. may be setting ourselves up to be losing a lot of those, as we're losing a lot of the rest of our industrial base around the world.
Roger, do you think that the U.S. will be left behind? Will end up losing jobs by not being a part of
really
this push
not,
for?
Not at all. One of the things that I think the salvation in this long-term problem with global warming is technology. I think everybody recognizes that. The Kyoto Protocol tweaks a little bit at the edges and has a little impact here and a little impact there, but it may make a lot more sense to redirect some of these resources we're using now to meet short-term Kyoto Protocol targets, redirect those resources into the development of appropriate R&D.
But, Roger, that appropriate R&D, that impetus is happening right now in European countries where different companies are getting the rewards for doing that.
No more so than in the U.S. I mean, one of the activities that the Bush administration has promoted is $1 billion into this and $1 billion into that. Tim's right. I mean, right now we're using internal combustion engines. We're going to be moving to hybrids. We're going to be moving to fuel cells. There's a whole host of technologies that are going to have to come online, and in fact will come online over the next 50 years. They're likely to come online whether or not the Kyoto Protocol is achieved. Now, I certainly support policies to discourage the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. I think we want policies to discourage those emissions, and we want policies to encourage R&D to develop other energy and transportation approaches. But I don't think that necessarily is tied to the Kyoto Protocol. I think the U.S. is doing that right now. And some of the other countries, incidentally, China, for example, apparently has a fairly intensive and ambitious program of small nuclear power plants that may have the effect of completely allowing China to completely leapfrog some of the dirty energy period. Now, China's not a ratifier of the Kyoto Protocol.
Right.
Nevertheless, China is moving ahead, and I think the U.S. is moving ahead.
I want to go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire for our next call. Bill's joining us from there. Bill, what do you think?
Well, good morning. I become rather frustrated whenever Kyoto and global warming becomes the topic. To me, the issue is pollution and the squandering of petroleum resources. And what typically happens is we have a glaciologist, as you did, or an oceanologist, if that's a word, who talks about disappearing islands and reefs. And yes, the Earth's temperature is changing, but that doesn't mean that it was necessarily done by man or that it was would not occur otherwise. I think we're cyclical on temperature. And the effect of the sun can't be measured beyond the last decade or so, which is the most important part of the warming formula. We don't know. We can't monitor a baseline of the sun temperature.
Bill, I'm going to take the point that you're making and not deal with it directly. I hope you forgive me on this. But we didn't want to actually set up a debate over the science. I think, though, Tim Wirth, that it's notable to say that debate still exists. And I'm wondering to what extent the U.S. Political decision not to roar ahead has to do with the fact that there's still an argument in some quarters about whether or not the science is reliable.
Well, I'd be interested in Roger's reaction. My belief is that the science is pretty well in now.
But you recognize there's a debate there.
Around the world.
No?
There are skeptics out there. There are people who don't believe it. But I think overwhelmingly the thrust in the science community is that we are having a direct impact on the climate and that we ought to do something about this. If we don't want to court disaster down the line.
Roger,
and that's how you get into all of these technologies.
Are we past the scientific debate, Roger?
Well, I think at one level we are. There's no question, I think, the science is strongly supports the notion that humans are impacting global warming and that they're part of this process. I think what's less certain is how much other factors are influencing this. Again, the IPCC, which has done scientific work on this when trying to explain climate change over the last 100 years or so, uses two factors. It uses human activities, but it also does this against a backdrop of natural changes. So the fact that we might neutralize human activities doesn't necessarily guarantee that the climate is going to, quote, stabilize. On the other hand, I would support the idea that where humans are having a significant impact on this on the climate process, we need to pay attention to that. And if it's a problem, which I think it is, then we need to try to develop programs and approaches to deal with that.
Tim, what do you think?
Oh, I don't disagree with that. There may be some natural causes in all of this, but I think we can see from the records that Lonnie talked about and that oceanographers have talked about in terms of looking at the seabed, that we can really track the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere over tens of thousands of years now and watch the temperature when the carbon in the atmosphere gets higher concentration, temperatures go up, and when it goes down, temperatures go down. We can see that, and we can see, you know, that we have increased through man's activities very significantly the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere. I think that going back to the point that Roger started us with, looking at these technologies, this is a tremendous opportunity for the U.S. and for the world. The caller from Portsmouth suggested we're squandering resources. Well, there's no question about the fact that we're significantly squandering the oil resources of the world, and we have some opportunities to dramatically change that. Now, that is also good for our political security. Our energy security. We're in a situation now, this will get you into the geopolitical realm, but we're in a situation now where we're increasingly dependent on the most politically volatile area of the world, the Middle East. And, you know, that it doesn't seem to me and to most analysts of the sort of international world that that's a wise place for us to be. We want to begin to temper our increasing dependence.
All right, Connection listeners, let's go back to where we are on this. We know that with Russia's signing of the Kyoto Protocol and the European backing of that, it is going ahead on this day. Tony Blair, as something of a representative of Europe, is in Washington trying to encourage the U.S. to consider seriously a greater involvement in working on matters of climate change. What difference does it make having the U.S. out of the picture right now? Is it a country that's so big that in or out, these issues are going to include the U.S., or would the United States be better off if it was more directly involved? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Cambridge next. Dick's on the line from there. Hi, Dick.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. What do you think?
Well, the one thing that strikes me that's missing from the U.S. policy is some market mechanism, some cap-and-trade system, which Kyoto introduced. McCain-Lieberman bill, the last time it was brought to the Senate floor, got 43 votes. And it strikes me that technology is the one thing that everybody says is going to help ameliorate, mitigate this problem. But without any kind of other market-based solution where you can attempt to capture a value, a market value of what people are going to be willing to pay for, you know, helping this problem, helping to solve this problem, we're not going to get very far.
You know,
it strikes me that the Bush administration has been really reluctant in going down the road of at least curating some kind of market-based mechanism whereby you can see what this stuff is worth.
And as Roger pointed out, the Senate hasn't exactly been keen to go ahead with this, but Dick, it seems to me that every time this subject gets raised, if anybody talks about a lost job or some economic downside of it, then the whole conversation is closed. Nobody wants to go ahead with it.
Well, but this problem is a problem where the benefits are hundreds of years away and the costs are immediate. And at some point, I mean, this is going to be a hard problem to ever solve with a conventional benefit-cost analysis.
All right, Tim Worth, you were a senator. You know how Washington works. If it's not going to happen in the next 4 years, does that mean nobody will ever talk about it?
Well, that's a good point. It makes it tough. But let's go back to, you know, the cap-and-trade idea and economic instruments that have to be introduced, as the caller very properly suggests. Much of this debate that we're hearing today about carbon is a debate that we heard about sulfur in the 1970s and 1980s, when there was a real problem with acid rain. New England and the East Coast was screaming that Middle West utilities were sending their sulfur dioxide into the East. Now, the Congress finally figured out how to break that through a very innovative and creative cap-and-trade system and setting a limit on the amount of sulfur, and it has worked extraordinarily well and has made the diminution of acid rain probably 8 to 10 times cheaper than it would have been otherwise. We have to do the same sort of thing with carbon, and the first thing we have to do is to establish a price on carbon. That's what the initial part of Kyoto is going to do.
I got to stop you right there. We're going to come back and continue the conversation after a short break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Kyoto Protocol, climate change, the U.S. not being in it. What are the implications? We'd like to hear from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This hour, a chance to take the temperature of the economic and political side of the debate over U.S. involvement in the Kyoto Accord. The accord itself, the protocol, is now in effect. The U.S. remains on the outside. European nations say they will be and are pressing ahead on ways to reduce the production of greenhouse gases. This is a little bit about science, but it's also a lot of politics. Joe Stelbecki is Director General for Environment at the European Commission. He was also the chief negotiator on climate change. Talked with him a little bit earlier this morning. Asked him if the ongoing, continuing decision of the U.S. not to participate will in any way spoil the efforts of all the other countries.
Of course, the first one to suffer is the climate, because the emissions worldwide, the emissions coming from the United States are some 25%, and that's a significant share. So that's why we think that climate change is a long-term problem. We have to continue our discussion, and even if the United States do not join us today, We still hope and work towards a world within which also the United States is going to join us. Now, having said that, the Kyoto Protocol is putting forward a number of specific elements, specific issues, specific targets. We can enter into a debate if one or the other element is particularly problematic for the United States. I think in those discussions we should discuss them and see whether there are alternative ways to reach the same effect.
And that was the last thing that I wanted to ask you about. I am reading and hearing from economists and scientists who are saying that the Kyoto Protocol is now a little bit out of date, that there perhaps are other better ways of controlling the release of greenhouse gases, and perhaps it would be more constructive to set aside that protocol because it still has it those sort of divisive parts to it, and clear the slate, try to work on something else that's brand new. What do you think of that?
I think we did a lot of effort on this Kyoto Protocol together with the United States and with all parties in the world. So we think we have to give this protocol the chances it deserves to get started. But getting started means as well that along the way you have to look backward and see what can be improved, what can be monitored in a better way. And there are some very attractive elements also for the United States in the Kyoto Protocol. And I only want to mention one, and that is the system of emissions trading that exists in the United States for sulfur that we have studied in Europe very intensively, that now we introduce in Europe for greenhouse gas emissions, and we would think that such a system can be very attractive for our businesses and our corporations to reduce carbon and get a reward for that on the market. So we hope that this emissions trading regime that is very new for the Europeans, and again, that we learn from the United States, that this is going to be an element on which we can build further efforts in the future.
Mr. Delbecchi, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jos Delbecchi is Director General for Environment at the European Commission, picking up the point there that Tim Wirth was making earlier in the program, that the example of emissions trading in the days of controlling sulfur in the United States should be seen as a way of moving ahead to carbon trading under the Kyoto Accord. We're interested in hearing your thoughts on what the U.S., what the implications are of the U.S. sitting on the sidelines of the Kyoto Accord are. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Belmont, Massachusetts next, and Ingrid's on the line. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
I think the purpose of the Kyoto Protocol, in large part, is to educate the public. And in Bush's decision not to participate, he's choosing not to educate the public. And my example is I go to Canada quite a lot, and I see half-hour programs on emissions trading. And you have people in the backwoods of Canada learning about this. And I don't think you're going to get to your 50% if you don't get the first five. I feel like you have to convert the people to thinking this way.
You mean even if you're not necessarily teaching them how the market in carbon trade works, you're at least getting them thinking about the importance of these issues?
Yeah. I mean, it's a hard sell to some of these people that this might be a problem. And you can't walk into their living room and sell them that they have to cut things by 50%. I think the purpose of the protocol can say, okay, we have to start somewhere. We're going to start with five.
Okay, Ingrid, thanks for that. Roger Sedgwick, I wonder if she doesn't have something there when the U.S. government, whether it's Senate or the president, says, no, we're not going to sign on to that. Is there not a signal being given that the issue itself isn't that important?
Well, I think you've got to recognize that there's a lot of work going on right now in the U.S. on these subjects. The gentleman from Europe pointed out that on the cap-and-trade system, the Europeans have learned from the U.S. In my organization, we have a number of people working on a cap-and-trade system involving carbon. We have a Chicago Climate Exchange that has a voluntary system involving essentially cap-and-trade among 40 or 50 of the large corporations oriented toward carbon. One of the things that's happening in the U.S. is the number of states, California among them, are taking initiatives on their own. And I view this first 10 or 15 years as a learning period. The notion that there's a lot for us to learn about how to do this properly, I think, is correct. I think we're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way. I think there is an education process here. The other thing I think is important to point out is that the other countries, even those that have signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, aren't all doing that well. If I look at where Japan and Canada and the EU were, their actual emissions in 2000 compared with their target emissions, all of them are having problems. The EU is doing the best, but the EU had a special situation that made it easier for them to achieve their targets. Canada is way above their targets, or was way above in the year 2000, is continuing to move upward. Japan is also substantially above, with a little prospects, really, I think, within the their plans that they've developed thus far of meeting those targets. So it's one thing to sign on. It's another thing to actually make progress. I think intellectually people are understanding climate exchanges, they're understanding cap and trade systems, they're understanding the fact that an energy tax, or at least a carbon tax, might provide some incentives toward developing the kinds of technologies we need to have.
Okay, Timworth, I'm going to come to you on that in just a moment, but I want to go next to a call in Lawville, New York. Charlie's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, good morning.
Somebody was just saying here on the program that you know, cap and trade and climate change and Kyoto, these are things that are well understood. What do you think?
Well, we listen to your show quite often, and thank you for taking my call. But we don't actually understand and know completely what the Kyoto Treaty is, nor do we understand the Kyoto Protocol, which has been so often noted on your program.
Right.
And the whole program has been about the Kyoto Treaty and Kyoto Protocol and has left us just a little bit in the dark. But we've enjoyed the program, and we listen on a regular basis.
Charlie, I thank you for your call. And Tim Wirth, this goes to your own history as a politician, where there's a message. And what's lost if all you do is talk about it in the abstract?
Well, let's just go back to the last 3 months. We had a presidential campaign. We had three presidential debates, a vice presidential debate. I do not remember the word climate being issued by either of the candidates or the questions of energy even raised by any of the moderators during this national debate. And in my opinion, that was a real dereliction of duty by both the networks in the their responsibility of bringing issues out, and in the candidates' refusal to even talk about energy. I mean, it was hardly on the agenda. So I think the woman talking about public education is absolutely correct, as is the gentleman saying, what's Kyoto all about? This is going to take a lot of education.
All right, so what's your 60-second primer for Charlie? He's still listening. What would you say to bring him in?
The 60-second primer is that the United States and the rest of the world agreed to a framework convention on climate change in 1992, which said that climate is a major issue and we have to start reducing our emissions. Kyoto is a first step. It's a protocol. It's the first implementation device for the 1992 climate treaty. And it calls for the reductions of approximately 5% in the emissions by industrialized countries. It does not include non-industrialized countries, particularly India and China, and that's one of the bones of contention. So when Roger says, how well are we doing? Well, people aren't doing very well in terms of reductions. You know, we're having a hard time even stabilizing emissions, but we've learned a lot through cap and trade, through sinks, through the international negotiation process, through the economics, through the examination of technology, and now we're going to be at a second implementation stage, which is sort of Kyoto 2 or some protocol number 2 to implement the International Climate Treaty. It will probably not be called Kyoto because Kyoto is so complicated. It may be the Buenos Aires Protocol or it might be the Washington Protocol, but there will be a second step picking up on what we've learned so far to try to take the climate negotiations to the next level.
All right, Charlie, I hope that is helpful for you. If you want to take a look at what's happening, we have on our website at theconnection.org some NASA animation that are showing the way that the rising temperature in the Arctic in particular is affecting the polar ice cap and the tundra and the environment up in that area. The Kyoto Protocol that we're talking about is this international agreement that's supposed to slow that down. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Arlington, Massachusetts, Jim's on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hi, this is Jim Marzilli. I'm a member of the state legislature in Massachusetts, and I've been delighted to hear the talk about the carbon cap and trade mechanism, especially because as we speak, in New York, there are approximately 100 people meeting as part of a year-long process from throughout the New England area to create a carbon cap-and-trade mechanism. It's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it's being led by the governors of the New England states, plus New York, New Jersey, Delaware, with observers from other states and other nations.
This is what Roger was saying earlier, Jim, that if there isn't national leadership, then there will be regional and state leadership. That's what you're talking about, right?
It's both state and local leadership. In fact, last year at the round of negotiations in Milan, the head of the U.S. delegation started off the proceedings by indicating that, yes, in fact, progress is being made in the United States by state and local government.
But can I ask you if you think it's good enough, though, Jim? I guess in part I'm going back to the point that Ingrid was making earlier in terms of national leadership. Are you saying that, you know, if it doesn't happen in Washington, it's going to happen locally and that's fine, or that more needs to be done as well?
If it doesn't happen nationally, it will happen locally, but we need much more. In fact, what we're getting is just the opposite. We have the threat, for example, that the Congress and the President will preempt states from acting. For example, they'll preempt us from acting on creating higher energy efficiency standards for appliances. We have the threat that they'll intercede politically with the governors of the northeastern states, most of whom are Republicans, but who are leading the charge despite the President's obstinacy on this.
Right, and who were instrumental in on the question of sulfur and acid rain. I remember that very clearly. Tim Wirth, I guess I'm drawn from Jim's point to ask you if we might, I might be making a bit of a mistake saying, okay, the federal government is not bought into Kyoto, therefore nothing's happened. Are you encouraged by what's happened locally? Is that an adequate...
Well, it's very important in our history of our system is that things don't just happen from Uncle Sam on down.
Right.
You know, we have initiatives that come from the states up, and that's the way our federal system works and works well. What Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing in California, what Governor Pataki and the New England states are doing is terrific. It's very, very important. And what's happening elsewhere. In my own state of Colorado just passed a ballot initiative requiring utilities to have a 10% renewable energy by 2015. And 16 other states have a similar standards. That's a step in the right direction. What's happening right there in your backyard on the Cape Wind project, controversial as it may be, you know, that's a step in the right direction.
Okay, so but is it enough? Should something be coming from Washington as well?
Of course it should be. Of course it should be, but it's not going to be, I don't think, right now. So we got to do the best we can and hope that there'll be this very interesting trading program going on, say, between New England, New York, and European utilities. I mean, that's something that's never been done before, one, to trade internationally that way, and secondly, to trade between countries in Europe and states in the United States. Now, that's going to be a real breakthrough. That's what the caller from the state legislature, I think, was talking about. And that's a very important initiative and a very interesting one that will increase pressure on the U.S. to act, too.
All right, lots of different ways to look at it. I want to thank the two of you for taking time out of your day to help us. Timothy Wirth, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Dick.
Timothy Wirth is president of the UN Foundation and former U.S. Senator and Congressman from Colorado. Roger Sedgo, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Roger is senior fellow at Resources for the Future in Washington, D.C., a little bit earlier in the program. We talked with Dr. Lonnie Thompson, a glaciologist at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio University, and Joe Stelbecki, Director General for Environment at the European Commission. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.